Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I thought about titling this the beginning of the end in Syria, but really it's not going to be the end in Syria. What's really happening is the beginning of the end of the Assad family, correct, Jim?
Yes, your tribal cultures, when they have a regime change, it's usually the first of several bloody chapters. And we're seeing that played out in Afghanistan. In fact, I think we did a piece. I don't know if it ran, you know, the last couple of days, but it's, you know, basically detailing, you know, all the ins and outs of the last 40 years of Afghan history. I mean, this all began with a, you know, this guy deposing his cousin, the king, and, you know, 40 years later, they're still killing each other over that. You know, and that's, you know, like we do a Strategy Page, I summed it up, you know, and people do like this, because it's otherwise a complicated situation. You know, you go to Stratfor or some of those other sites, and, you know, it's like a New Yorker article. You know, you're there a couple of days before you get to the punchline. But while they do drag on, they all drag on for the same reason. The country was not really united in the first place. In other words, the tribal coalitions with historically, with one guy, you know, nominally the head of the country, quote-unquote, who's mainly there to deal with outsiders. Internally, the politics is more, you know, by consensus among the major players. This, you know, was how it was in, especially in Syria. It's how it always was in Afghanistan. It's how it was in Somalia. But the guy in charge, you know, put on airs. And, you know, 20 years later, they're still trying to sort that out. I mean, for example, in Kismayo, there's been real bloody fighting played out. In fact, I think Austin might have mentioned there's a big brew up in Darfur. So the rebels are rebelling against each other. So, you know, what we're going to see in Syria is Assad will eventually collapse, and that's not going to be, you know, nice to observe. But then you've got all these other factions. You know, come to think of it, you know, with all the places we cover, Yemen is playing out like that. Mali, you're going to see that because you've got several different factions of Tuareg up there, plus the black Malis from the south. And then, of course, Al-Qaeda. So none of these things are going to end, you know, neatly. Like, you know, in the West, we think of a civil war or a revolution as a one-act play. In other parts of the world, you know, they just go on and on and on. It can take literally decades. And again, if you want an example, look at Afghanistan.
Austin, what is the current situation in Syria right now, and what are things looking like as far as how long the Assad family has left before they either buy a bullet or are pushed out of the country?
I've been hesitant to put a date on when the Assads leave from the beginning, and I think my hesitancy is shown to have been reasonable. I do think they're goners. But as Jim has described this, you know, he says these tribal coalitions, some of them are, another way to think of them is like they're old-time empires is what they are. And I mean by that is that they have all the coalition elements, but there's one group that is more in charge than the other group. And the Alawites, which are the tribe slash religious group, ethnic group that the Assad family, to which the Assad family belongs, has been the played that role in Syria. I don't know when when they'll be gone. As Jim said, and I said a moment ago, they will be gone. Now, what's going on? Well, let's talk about what's going on among some of the more noteworthy players. Radical Sunnis, Al-Qaeda types. This is another opportunity for them, at least they see if that is an opportunity for them, and that there's the chaos to take advantage of. They've got weapons. They've got some money. They've got utterly committed zealots in their organization who are willing to fight, willing to die, willing to kill. That's really probably that, willing to kill other people for no matter who they are. They're certainly active. They are active in the northeastern Kurdish corner. You know, strategy page, we had this on either earlier this month or late in January, a couple of reports, and they were claims from one of these groups that's described as aligned with Al-Qaeda, that Turkey had supplied them with weapons. I noticed that the Turks denied this vehemently. But one of these splinter factions, they actually, the fellow that had the made the claim to the press, and I believe it was in early February, so it would have run in February. He claimed his group was active in the Ras Al Ain area of the town in northeastern Syria, which is a Kurdish country, and they'd been fighting these Kurdish local defense forces, or Kurdish militias that are part of the really the Kurdish wing of the Kurdistan Workers Party. And those guys are active. They see it as an opportunity. Who's supporting them? Who supports Al Qaeda, Dan? They're attracted to the cauldrons such as this. Syrian Kurds have been playing. They're playing this as close to the vest as they possibly can. The Syrian branch of the PKK is in the Assad family's pocket. They had been given refuge by the Assads. They were a card to play against the Turks in the sense that we could provide refuge, another base for the PKK if Ankara pushes us too hard. And yet, there are a substantial number of Kurds, Syrian Kurds, that you would have to classify as moderates, reasonable, trying to determine what the next deal is going to be, what the next coalitional relationship. Go back to Jim's first statement is going to be after the Assad's fall. One of their big demands has been that they want recognition. If they're going to be in Syria, as Syria, assuming that it still exists as it's constituted now as a nation, they want citizenship rights so they can get passports. The Assad's played games with played games with the Syrian Kurds on you're not citizens, you are citizens, you're residents, and they use it as a dictatorship uses a cudgel to both oppress and reward the Kurds. They want that settled in some shape, form, or fashion. Now, moving to the rest of the kaleidoscope of Syria, there are Syrian Sunni Arabs want the Assads gone. They would like, Jim will come into this, you know, they want to, some of these groups want to establish their own corrupt regimens. I didn't say regime, but they want their slice of the corruption machine. Some of the individuals and groups in this diverse group are looking. They're part of that Syrian National Council. They would like a elected government that operating on at least quasi-democratic principles. And I say this with some trepidation, but they look at what's happened in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and of course that hasn't been worked out and won't be worked out for 20 or 30 years, but they say if the other Arab states on the Mediterranean littoral are doing it. Why shouldn't we? And they bring along a collection of intellectuals, business people, with and some other religious minorities, generally the educated or the technical elites from the other communities. And then we get into the hodgepodge of these other communities, Armenians, Greek Orthodox, Christians, other Christian sects. There are a few Chaldeans and Nestorians, Chaldeans in there, Maronites live from across the Lebanon. I mean, Syria in some ways is a big Lebanon, Dan, with the same kind of pizza pie of ethnic and religious groups. Some of these groups actually made common cause with the Alawites, because the Alawites are a minority. They're 10%, perhaps 10% of the population, and they were at least the regime gave them enough of the goodies to keep to keep them satisfied, so the regime could focus on its Sunni Arab rivals. They could be vulnerable to a takeover by radical Sunnis, you know, the influence of an al-Qaeda type group, hardline factions of the Syrian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. So I'm not sure how much influence they ultimately have, but they know, they sense their vulnerability, and they're trying to figure out where the pieces are going to fall and what the new arrangements will be, just like the Kurds are, but then they're even more fragmented than the Syrian Kurds. So now I've kind of gone from the basement. You ask what's happening, and then, of course, the other thing that's happening is the violence, neighborhood wars. These are neighborhood wars that have been extended in Damascus, Aleppo as well. There are parts of the country now that the Free Syrian Army, which has getting supplies and support paid for by Gulf Arab states, interestingly enough, some of their weapons have come from Croatia. Apparently the Saudis bought, not apparently, it's been reported in Reuters and numerous other wire services, the Saudis went to the Balkans to buy weapons for some of the Free Syrian army factions. Gutter has allegedly been involved in it. I won't open the Pandora's box about who Gutter was fronting for, but some of that has supposedly been us as well, Dan. And who's directing it? I think a lot of this is locally directed and locally determined, because I don't see the signs of a well-coordinated insurgency. But it is an insurgency that has the key component of a successful insurgency, and that is it doesn't stop. It just keeps going, and they've demonstrated resiliency. And they've demonstrated, the various groups under the umbrella of the Free Syrian Army have demonstrated resiliency. You could have, and I'd be interested in Jim's comment on this, on this point, after the Assads leave, you have a repeat of the ongoing situation in Libya of local militias that don't disarm and regard themselves as the government in their neighborhood. And that's the violent aftermath that Turkey certainly doesn't want, Israel doesn't want, and you hear the Iraqis say, we don't want that kind of spillover coming back on us. So,
Jim?
It is a complex situation, but I think you can understand it better if you look at how the war is being fought. You basically have a multitude of wars. In other words, like all politics is local, well, in Syria, all warfare is local. Very few of the rebel groups will travel from one part of the country to another. And this is the same pattern that happened in Syria, you know, and to a large extent in Yemen and the other countries where, you know, in Libya and what have you, where there was a civil war. It was a war where the armed forces that organized themselves locally, I mean the rebel forces, proved strong enough to defeat whatever government troops could be sent against them. Now, the Syrian army has been eroding week by week by desertion. If they lose, if they haven't already lost all of their Sunni troops, and the Sunnis are 80% of the population, I estimate they're down to maybe 100 or so thousand people that they can trust. A lot have just left. I mean, not gone over to the rebels. They just want no part of it. They drop their weapons or, you know, sell them or hide them or whatever the case may be, get into the civilian clothes, go back to the village, and in some cases head for the border to get into a refugee camp where they won't be bombed by the Syrian Air Force. You have major battles in places like Aleppo, the largest city in the country. That's in the north by the Turkish border. And this is where a lot of the Islamic radicals are coming in because they can get in through Turkey. They have a harder time getting in through Iraq, which is basically an ally of the Assad's, an unofficial ally. The Iraqis are very friendly to Iran, and they're trying as much as possible not to be seen as backing Assad. For example, they've allowed there are, you know, Western Iraq is almost all Sunni. That's Anbar province. And a lot of the tribes along the Syrian, you know, Iraq border are actually have clans on both sides of the border. So Iraq learned early on it's wise not to try and, you know, stop this, you know, business of one part of a tribe helping another part of a tribe on the other side of the border. So in effect, Iraq has lost control of Anbar, or at least the border, again. I mean, trucks still go back and forth, but they have to basically, be ready to, you know, pay off, whatever faction, you know, the Syrian army or the rebels they run into, or have their loads and their trucks stolen, if they can. What the rebels are trying to do, even with this inkblot, you know, coalition of forces that are basically stuck where they are, is trying to coordinate what they're doing. That's why, over the last couple of months, the Syrian rebels have concentrated on controlling roads and attacking military bases. Now, this often involves simply laying siege to the military base. In other words, shutting down the roads, or at least making the roads almost in for all practical purposes, impassable to supply trucks. In other words, you're going to basically starve out, you know, the troops in there. The government has had to basically use a lot of their armed forces, who are basically outgunned. I mean, the armed forces they have that are loyal, that are, as Austin pointed out, are Alawites and a lot of the other minorities. That, by the way, is a classic routine for a minority government. The Iraqis did it. And of course, the Syrians are doing it. Where the Alawites went to all the other minorities and said, "Hey, look, you know, the majority Sunnis hate us or will hate us, and they'll kill us if they get a chance. So why don't we all get together and I'll make it worth your while?" And for decades that worked. But now, as Austin pointed out, a lot of these minorities are headed for the border because, you know, they see the revenge coming. But the troops that are still in uniform and being fed, and actually apparently being paid in most cases, they can move if they don't get ambushed too often from one part of the country to another. But that is becoming more and more limited because the rebel, the high command of the FSA, the Free Syrian Army, realized that if the government is not mobile, they can be basically chopped to pieces, you know, wherever they are. The army is strongest in Damascus. And it used to be Aleppo, although some of those, they've sent piddling reinforcements, a few hundred here, a few hundred there. And, of course, the Air Force, which is running out of spare parts and fuel and bombs and what have you, if they can limit the government's minority, not only can the, is the government stopped from feeding and supplying their troops with ammunition and fuel and what have you, but the supplies don't get through to the civilians who support the government. You've got about 10-15% of the civilians basically back the Assads. Now, the one thing the Assads have going for them, remember, Damascus is way down in the south near the Israeli border and the Jordanian border. The one area that is loyal, really loyal, to the Assads is the area around Syria's short coastline, which is up, you know, in the northwest.
Yeah, so they're
ports. Exactly. They have a couple of ports, you know, none of them huge, but big enough to bring in freighters and what have you, and Russian warships. These ports are, this area up here, which is relatively small, but it's almost, it's the Alawites predominate. And they have organized militias and what have you. So that's the ultimate safe haven. But the problem is, all the big shots who've been living large down in Damascus, you know, for decades, you gotta get up there. So what's been happening, and this doesn't get reported much, but, you know, from what I hear, you know, in Lebanon and even Jordan, the big shots have been sending their families out of the country. So they've got these convoys of, you know, vehicles, fairly high, you know, high-end, you know, cars, heading across the border. And, all of a sudden you have these new, affluent families popping up, you know, in, Lebanon and, usually beyond, out of the Middle East. They try to send them, you know, as far away as possible. That's a sign, you know, that the leadership of the Assad, you know, government, are not absolutely sure they're going to win. In fact, one reason why it's difficult to predict exactly when this is going to stop is that the decision is one guy. Now, you can predict what a large group of people are going to do. You know, we've been doing that with more and more success over the last century. But predicting what one person will do is extremely difficult. For all practical purposes, impossible. You know, Bashar Assad is under a lot of pressure to make a deal, to get out, to do this, do that, to, you know, scorched earth. And one of his brother is apparently particularly bloody-minded. You know, kill more of them. But they're running out of money. They're running out of, you know, roads they can use. They're running out of ammunition. You know, Iran can only do so much. Iran, for example, its most recent initiative is to try and organize a street fighting, you know, group, you know, elite troops, as it were, and, with Iranian advisors, and basically go in there and just, you know, scorched earth airy neighborhoods that are being held by the rebels, to exterminate them, as it were. Now, that, in theory, could work, but the problem is, the rebels are not stupid. Most of them are civilians with guns. They can easily blend in. That's why you hear occasionally stories of the army just rounding up, you know, military age men, just, you know, taking them away and probably killing most of them. Again, this is common. You go back every war, the Balkans in the 90s, you know, these are the basic rules you end up playing by, because these conditions, when they occur, you have how many options? And the problem with the Assad is that time is not on his side. You know, he's got the EU blockade. Now, Iran would supply him, but of course Iran has its own economic crisis right now because of the embargo. But, you know, they can only send so much through Iraq, and that has limited utility because then they have to run the gauntlet of, Sunni tribes in eastern Syria. So, I mean, Assad, you know, what's he got going for him? He's got the Russians on his side. He's got the Iranians. Well, with friends like that, you might as well just, you know, pack it in. That's why you occasionally hear a burble in the news about somebody offering him, you know, safe passage to get out. And that apparently is the best deal he can get right now if he doesn't wait too long. Because every day that goes by, because of cell phones and the internet, more and more atrocities are being recorded, and more Syrians are basically bringing this down to the blood feud level. And when you get down to blood feud, there is no compromise. You know, blood for blood, as it were. And this is why, you know, some of Assad's, you know, allies are telling me, says, you know, look, let's get out while we can, you know, it's all over. But he's the man in charge. He's running a police state. He has a lot of people who haven't got too many options. They're really depending on his leadership. If it all collapses, there'll be a bloodbath. There already have been some bloody, you know, bloody sectarian, you know, massacres in various parts of Syria. So we're all waiting on Assad. But ultimately, you know, in weeks or months, it'll be out of his hands. You know, once the rebels have surrounded Damascus and cut it off completely, once they've shut down all the major airports, then it's just a matter of time, you know, for him. There's no more decisions he can make, you know, except to, you know, put a bullet in his head himself or have one of his close friends do it and basically run. And that's why the war is over for the Assad, but nobody can predict exactly when it's going to be over.
Austin, where could the Assad family go? What countries would accept them at this point?
Well, you give me the... I give you the tough questions,
Austin.
Austin, you're a novelist, aren't you? Well, yeah, Dan, I've written three thrillers, so why don't you just check it in? One comment on that. Jim and I both described in our own ways this chaotic war. And that's, you see why I call it a war of neighborhoods, don't you? I mean, I've written that on strategy page. For what it's worth, I mean, this is, you know, it's all this, hey, let's use the same words because they apply. Jim mentioned back in the Balkans. Jim, I believe we used war of neighborhoods to describe what was going on in Sarajevo. Yeah, and the quick and dirty guide to war days. In fact, I believe I know we did, but there's the echo of it. Okay, where can they go? Let me ask you a question, Dan, and then I will give an answer. Now, where is it Muammar Gaddafi could go? Where could Gaddafi go? Do you recall?
He went into Overt and got killed.
Well, I know he got killed, but where could it go? I'm talking about Venezuela. Talking about Zimbabwe,
Cuba, Russia, and all the places people love to retire to.
But they were talking about Syria too. Okay.
That's right. That's another problem that has little talked about. All the bad guys who were hanging out in Syria, Austin could probably get some good novels out of that because they all ran undercover and their story has not been told.
Well, North Korea, but look, Iran. When you first asked it, I was going to say Iran, but I kind of wanted to go around through some of the rogue possibilities. Iran has invested a great deal in the Assads because the Assads, for several reasons. We'll just talk about the classic, it's a classic aphorism. It's true. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. And even though Iraq now is trying to placate, and I think that's the way when Jim was talking about Iraq's situation, Iraq is caught and has been forever Mesopotamia between Syria and whoever is over there as the in Arianistan, Persia, Iran, Arianistan, land of the Aryans, the Semites of Mesopotamia, Arabs in this case, and some of the other groups that have filtered into Mesopotamia over the millennia, Kurds, are caught between whoever is in along the Mediterranean littoral. Iran, Persia. So, Iraq is, again, quote unquote, caught in that vice. But from the Iranian perspective, their enemies in Mesopotamia have, people who do not like them. They're my friend because of geography, and that's the Assyrians in this case. That's one reason. Second is the Alawites are nominally Shias. Iran is a Shia Islam, predominantly Shia Islam. So there's this is something that the Khomeinists use constantly. They're trying to make deals with Shia groups. We're the protectors of the Shias. Now notice Iraqi Shias
overwhelmingly do not buy that. There are certain components that do, but that's a card that Iran plays. But Iran plays it very strongly with Lebanese Hezbollah. The Shia and Lebanon have felt that they, and they with reason, were the secondary, tertiary, bottom of the barrel group, even worse off than the Druze in some cases, in Lebanon because of all the wealthy Sunni and Christian Arabs in Beirut that had the money and the education and ran Lebanon. They were the largest outcast group. So Iran uses its money and influence, and it's turned Hezbollah into a proxy army for war with Israel, a proxy army for war with Sunnis and Christians in Lebanon as well. And the route to Hezbollah is through Syria with the full complicity of the Assad regime. Iran, and in some ways, what I'm if I put it in a military term, doesn't want to cut off its frontline forces. And in Lebanon, confronting the Israelis, they will lose that contact if the Assad regime falls. So the Iranians have an investment in the Assads. They have an investment in their security apparatus. One other point too, about Iran's deep connections with Lebanese Hezbollah and with the Assad regime. And I wrote about this in one of my columns this past month. And the Al-Quds, Revolutionary Guard Special Operations and Intelligence Organization, the Al-Quds general, who was the liaison contact, the Lebanese Hezbollah, was shot and killed in an ambush inside Syria, ostensibly by Libyan rebels. I just know what I've read in the press reports and in a very, very fine column written by the Middle Eastern commentator Amir Tahiri, who happens to be Iranian. I really appreciate Tahiri's work. And it said Syrian rebels. Well, of course, the conspiracy theorists, could the Israelis have done it? Of course they could have. Could one of the other groups in Lebanon that are fully antagonized by Lebanese Hezbollah and intimidated have carried out the hit? Sure. The guy was killed. And he has, again, this was something that Tahiri reported, and he said he sourced it to his own sources. He's got great sources inside Iran, that Iran was pumping $200 million a year, Dan, into Lebanese Hezbollah. And this general, Shatiri was the man's name, as a matter of fact, was responsible for it. Now, I painted out its money, prestige, all of it brought together, and Iran would be a logical place for the Assads to go.
Yeah. All well, right. I think that's, personally, I think that's one of their only choices, but I mean,
well, I mentioned Bob
other places. Yeah. But anyway, that pretty well wraps us up. We're out of time today. And we'll be back to Syria again, I'm sure. I think we've been hitting it about every other month, so, you know, since things started there. So thank you, and we'll talk to you next time.
Thanks. Bye.